So I put a new homework that is due next Tuesday. And this morning I made a slight change in that problem. Not change, just a clarification. And so if you printed it last night, print it again in problem number one. This homework is going to be relevant for the upcoming exam. That's next Wednesday, so that's the last one again, right? And after that, we'll have one more stretch that will be relevant for the final exam. Until then, just keep doing homeworks, learning new stuff, and the semester or the summer term is coming to an end in a hurry. And then we'll be all relieved and take the real summer vacation. Okay, so we were more or less at this level, all right? So we envision these two parallel plates, two plates that are large in some sense with a small separation in between, and focus on electric fields and magnetic fields that would comply with Maxwell's equations in between these plates, abiding more or less the what we would associate with a parallel plate capacitive type of approximation. Not focus on fringing fields and say within the place, when you are deep within the field, between the place, you are going to have an electric field that is going to be pointing from the bottom to the top plate independent of position, so that if we multiply that electric field with the distance, that would be some sort of a voltage. And there's going to be an orthogonal H, and that is complying with Maxwell's equations, which we are using here in any case. And that H, while it touches the boundaries, two plate boundaries, would be inducing then surface current densities to be compatible with it and Maxwell's boundary condition equations. And that current density integrated along the width W of this thing would give us some sort of a current I, equal and opposite flowing in opposite directions on the top and bottom plates. That's the picture. All right. To pursue that picture, then we looked at two Maxwell curl equations. Those two curl equations, vector equations, give two interesting scalar counterparts. One of them goes as ddz of E sub x, the other one goes as ddz of H sub y, with the corresponding right-hand sides. We act on these equations. We successively multiply each of these equations first with d, the distance between the two plates, and every time we see E sub x times d, we replace it with v, okay? But sometimes that d touches H sub y. We don't interpret d times h sub y as anything other than d times h sub y. But now, our new equations are subsequently multiplied with w, and whenever we see w times h sub y, we replace it with I. Now, if there is a w that is multiplying a v, we don't interpret anything other than v times I, okay? So this way, our equations ending up having i's and v's, as well as w's and d's floating around, okay? Sometimes we see these W's and these multiplying or dividing mu's and sigmas and epsilons. This is where we say, hey, geometrical factors multiplying epsilons, we learned earlier in the course to be capacitances per unit length, okay? And then mu's multiplying geometrical factors, which happen to be the inverse of the geometrical factor that is associated with the capacitance per unit length, were interpreted as? In mu goes as inductance per unit length. And then exactly the same geometrical factor multiplying sigma as epsilon was interpreted as conductance per unit length. Okay, so if I look at my equations at the end of the day, and these are my two equations now, they are more or less at that form. Okay, so let's look at this equation. This has dv dz, has some w, and di dt. Why don't I just divide this equation by w on both sides, then I have dv dz minus mu d divided by w. That is going to be, I think, inductance per unit length, because mu is in Henry's. Okay? So, and then if I go to this other equation, I have a d here. This is not derivative d. This is the separation between the plates. If I divide both sides of this equation by d, I'm going to have epsilon w divided by d, and that is capacitance per unit length. And its geometrical factor, w over d, is different than the d over w, the inverse of the other geometrical factor. So we're going to call the one that is accompanying epsilon in C definition as the geometrical factor, and refer to the other geometrical factor as 1 over the geometrical factor. That's how we're going to proceed from now on. Is that making sense? With all those changes, ladies and gentlemen, these two equations become these two equations. Now, when we say script L, we mean mu E divided by W. Script C is epsilon W over D. You see the geometrical factors are inverses of one another. So we have obtained a coupled set of differential equations, but scalar, not vector, in terms of V and I, that seem to have the capacitance, inductance, and conductance per unit length concepts that we had encountered earlier on. These are telegraphers' equations. So now, before discussing their solutions, let me make a few things clear. So we started with these two plates, right? The top plate and a bottom plate. Their separation is d. This is our z direction. The plate's width is w. Okay. In my derivation, there was a tacit implication that d is much, much less than w, but then w is much, much less than this length. Okay. We are thinking of sort of an indefinite length along the z directions, although we will work with chunks of it, okay? And so maybe I can put, for the time being, this L, and L being here, the largest one, and L can go all the way to infinity, okay? And once in a while, actually, we can take L to be less than W, but we have to be careful maybe in that sort of situation. Any questions here? Okay, so now, my V and I refers to every position Z on the line, okay? So let me identify here a particular value of Z and some put a dashed line here. My I refers to the current density J in X in Z direction that has been integrated along that dotted line. The collapse of the J surface along that dotted line gives us the I that I'm talking about on one plate. In the other plate, there is a corresponding dotted line exactly at the same Z value, and there too there is an I. It is actually the same I, but it is going in the opposite direction. I also have my V, right? My V is the line integral going one plate to the other. Our E in our derivation was simply D times E sub X, okay? But we can be a little bit more general about that, okay? That D times E sub X was the path independent value of the line integral of the electric field in between these two plates, so long as you kept your path that is at a constant Z plane, okay? Suppose that you took a line integral from this location onto this location, not exactly opposite, but in a diagonal sense, but always staying at constant z plane, okay? That line integral would still be e sub x times d that we have, and that would be what we define to be v of z. Is this clear? Alternatively, we could go and integrate from this location to this location, and still that would be the same. Because I'm claiming on constant z equals planes, we have a path-independent line integral of the electric field, as long as we keep on that plane. If we go outside that plane in our selection of path, then things will be sort of different, okay? And to illustrate that, let me just go from this point to this point, but instead of this path that is adhering to the z equal constant plane, it sort of meanders out, goes to larger values of z and comes back. I claim that this line integral will give me a E dot dl that is different from what we had before. Why is that? Because I know that there is going to be a flux that is going through the area that I have just created by considering those two path segments. Why is that? Because I know that my electric field that I have assumed for that problem is pointing in y direction, okay? So we have to go to the original picture, but we had the originally x-directed electric fields and y-directed magnetic fields. Those y-magnetic directed fields were always tangential to any closed loop I can draw on constant z plane, but as long as I make a loop that is emanating out, sticking out from the constant z plane, some of the magnetic field lines are going to be linking. And if there is linking magnetic field lines, their time variation would add to, would amount to a EMF, a line integral, that is non-zero. Okay? So basically, once again, writing down Faraday's law in an integral form, E dot dl over a closed interval is equal to minus dc dt. And only if deep C dt is equal to zero, we have E dot dl closed counter integral is equal to zero. Okay, with this funny path that I consider, I generate a path as well as an area for which a flux can be calculated. That is going to be not equal to zero. So this is not going to be equal to zero, and this is not going to be equal to zero. If that is not equal to zero, then I have different definition of voltage going from here to here versus going from here to there along the two paths. So now, the theory that we are coming up with is going to rely on our understanding the voltages that we have defined, presuppose a path-independent integral from one plane to the other plane, but sticking at each z value, at each constant z surface. Any questions? Are you understanding that? Okay. This is why I will be able to have a unique and unquestioned association of a V of C with every value of C. But don't expect to be able to measure that V of C with a voltmeter if you are not going to be careful to have the leads of your voltmeter stretched out on each constant z surface. If you go like this, you're going to have a different voltage reading. Okay? So we are now going to use a voltage concept which has its natural home in the quasi-statics and electrostatics, but we are applying in a dynamical situation. And we are able to get away with it as long as we stick with our constraints. Alright? So V of C is very important in that sense. Different V for each Z because of the difference coming from nothing other than that time rate of change of that flux. Okay? We are going to find ourselves in a situation, so let me erase this now and simplify the picture a little bit. When we have two transmission line wires, we will measure a certain V of C from one plate to the next at a given Z. Let me mark it like this. Some delta Z later on towards the load. If we were to look at the voltage with the same polarity, and we can label it V of C plus delta Z, in general, these two are not going to be the same. They are not going to be the same because actually I can think of a closed path that involves them, and the integration of the electric field around that closed lap has to equal, according to Faraday's laws, a deep psi dt, and there is a deep psi dt with a y-pointing magnetic field. There is a flux, and that flux is time-varying. Because of that, this voltage is not the same as this voltage. And those variations is what we are interested about. Those variations are the variations we ignore in lump circuit analysis. In lump circuit analysis, on two wires, we would always measure the same voltage, okay? Wherever we made our voltage measurements. And we wouldn't worry about the orientations of our leads of our voltmeter. Any questions? Because they all matter, we are doing this theory. All right, so let's get back to our equations then. We have two differential equations, sort of distilled, simplified, extracted out of Maxwell's equation with all the caveats that I have put down. And now it's time to do some math, okay? But when I look at these equations, I find an asymmetry. This equation is shorter than this equation. I have inductance per unit length, but in this one I have capacitance unit length as well as conductance per unit length. What's the physical reason why there is conductance per unit length? That physical reason is coming from sigma. That is coming from Maxwell's equations J. We model that J as sigma times E. That is what it is coming from, okay? And what does that refer to? It refers to the medium that is separating the two plates, okay? You can easily imagine that medium to be air or free space and just do away with sigma and then do away with that term, okay? But in general, our transmission lines have some sort of a material other than air supporting the separation between the two conductors. In coax, for instance, we have some sort of a plastic there separating inner and outer conductors. And we cannot be 100% sure that those materials are perfect insulators. So we should actually include a sigma there. So we did the right thing. And what is going to be the physical consequence of a slightly lossy separating material? It's going to cause losses or attenuation in propagating signal across these lines. It's a loss term.
Yes,
this is a loss term. Now, were we negligent in some sense? Are there other loss terms? By the way, this is a loss term that is typically referred to as dielectric loss. The reason for that is in a practical transmission line, you always put a material, a dielectric material, in between as a support that separates the two conductors of the system. You don't put a conductor, obviously. By putting a conductor, you short it out. You try to put something that has very little conductivity, but you can't avoid some, okay? So it's dielectric losses that comes. What is missing in this equation is another type of loss that you should be pretty sure is going to be happening. And what is that? What did we neglect? What is some other source of loss in the system that somehow we did not include in our analysis so far? If it is dielectric losses that we are accounting, what kind of losses we may not be accounting? What is the opposite of dielectric? Yeah, so we have somehow missed our conductor losses. We should actually change these equations, modify them. Why don't we have conductor losses? And what are conductor losses? Where do you think conductor losses may be happening in this system? Do you have a guess? Dielectric losses, that G accounts for dielectric losses. You understand that, right? I have just discussed that. This is because the two plates are separated by some material, plastic perhaps, and if there is a voltage, okay, and an electric field, there can be some small current that is driven through from one plate to the other, that if you wait long enough, will sort of like discharge one plate with respect to the other if the plate is not being charged again, okay? That kind of a loss. That is a dielectric loss, okay? And that is accounted for in that equation through the GV term. Are you with me now? But there is one more loss that I'm now bringing up that doesn't show up in this equation, and that somebody said is a conductor loss. So I ask you, where do you think that conductor loss is taking place in a real transmission line? Yeah. Say it again, loudly, so people hear. Yes. And why would there be that on the surface of the plates, other losses? Well, we talked about it yesterday, didn't we? Within the context of what I referred to as perturbation theory. Okay, we started this whole derivation under perturbation theory sort of an approach. Basically, I assumed that the two plates were perfect PECs. This is what gave me the indication that there is a surface current density. Okay, I said the tangential H on the two surfaces, I turned them into currents. I turned them first into J sub S, then integrated J sub S became RIs. Implicit in all that was me treating this thing as a perfect electrical conductor on the top and bottom plate, so that I talk about surface currents rather than actually if they were real coppers and aluminums and so forth, there wouldn't be any surface current, but there would be internal currents. Although within the perturbation theory way of looking at things, we often pretend those volumetric currents that are flowing within the few skin depths are equivalent to a surface current, and that is what we are effectively following here, okay? So then what does perturbation theory, according to what we saw yesterday, enable you to, you can do one more thing. Taking these equivalent surface currents, which are not real surface currents, but equivalent surface currents associated with real conducting materials rather than PECs, you can square them, multiply by 1/2, and multiply it with one more thing. What was that? Somebody, Lee. Yesterday, one example, we didn't go through it in detail, but I said a surface resistance, didn't I? There is a surface resistance, 1/2 surface resistance times J sub S squared gives you loss per unit area, watts per unit area, okay? So that is missing, okay? So in reality, our transmission line is going to be composed of two wires or two plates that are made from real conductors, not PECs. You can, because they are such good conductors, you can get the coolant surface currents pretending that they are PECs, but then you need to sort of square the surface currents, multiply with the surface resistance, and add one more loss term into that set of equations. So, ladies and gentlemen, what I can put here is one more term to this resistance per unit length multiplied by I, so that this equation becomes exactly symmetric and analogous to this equation. All right? But I will not do that until the very last day, until the very last lecture, when we do discuss effects of losses in transmission lines. Until then, we will discuss lossless transmission lines and idealization to real transmission lines, which are invariably lossy, but we'll pretend they are lossless, and learn how to analyze lossless transmission lines. Because at the end of the day, it turns out that if you know how to analyze lossless transmission line systems, it is very easy to correct whatever is not accurate there, to comply with the realities of lossy lines with very simple adjustments. They are so easy to state that it will take only 5 minutes in our last lecture, probably in the last 10 minutes of that class. Okay, so there is all the virtue now to pay attention to lossless transmission line system. And to make the system entirely lossless, I'm going to drop one thing from there. What will I drop, David? The G term. The GV term is going to go away. Poof, and we have simpler set of equations that we call telegrapher's equation. And here is the lossless telegrapher's equations written for you. Any questions? Now, although we derived this set of equations for the parallel plate case, had we started and done a little bit more elaborate derivation using the coaxial geometry or any other geometry, we would have still stumbled upon into the same set of equations. Except that in the other equations, we would have different definitions for inductance per unit length, conductance per unit length, and capacitance per unit length. There would be affected to different geometrical factors, nothing other than that. Okay. Now, your homework that's due tomorrow has a few problems in which you are supposed to calculate geometrical factors and come up with what I call the intrinsic impedance of a transmission line or the propagation velocity and so forth. Those are just exercises that are useful, and those make use of the equations in the margin. We have a geometrical factor of W over D for parallel plate transmission line. For a coax, it's 2 pi divided by ln B over A. For a twin lead, we have something that has even cosh. Cosh is inverse cosh, for that matter, hyperbolic cosine and inverse. Okay, so all of you have calculators that you calculate, or computers, you can calculate the homework problems to get some feel about different types of transmission lines. As far as what our theory in the class, we don't care which one of these transmission lines we are talking about. Okay, generic transmission line is what we're going to solve as we move along. Any questions? All right, so then what is next? Next is taking our telegrapher's equations, these equations, combine them, eliminate I in favor of V or V in favor of I, reduce it to a single equation and solve it. This is exactly parallel to our procedure that we follow with the two curl Maxwell's equations. We got a wave equation and we got the wave solutions. We're going to get the same thing here. We're going to get V waves and I waves, which are nothing other than some sort of a reduced representation of the electric field waves and the magnetic field waves, which I already know are trapped between these two plates. Okay, this is how we got that. So whenever you're talking of a B in a transmission line problem, don't lose sight that it is nothing other than a line integral or even a line multiplication, distance multiplication of an underlying electric field. There is always an electric field wave inside the transmission line. Likewise, and if you get confused about what I means, don't forget that I is related to the H that is orthogonal to the E that you were just thinking about, okay? So this relationship between E's and H's and B's and I's should never be forgotten. They always anchor you to reality. Therefore, if we get a wave equation here for V or I and solve it, you're going to get wave solutions that are just nothing other than the solution we already had for E's and H's. There's going to be nothing surprising. And because we got rid of the losses, we're going to get D'Alembert solutions. If we kept losses, then we would have to not stick in the time domain, but transport ourselves into the frequency domain using phasors, and then we would get equations that are similar to the lossy propagation problem. We are not going to do that until the very last day. Any questions? Okay, so then I derive my wave equation. All right? I basically go to the first telegrapher equation. Okay, so a few comments about the telegrapher's equations. Let's look at their form. First one says minus dv dz is equal to ldi dt. Okay? That's very similar to v equals ldi dt. V equals ldi dt is our inductor voltage current relationship that we remember from EC 110 and 210. Okay? The other equation, if it were not what it is, but it was I equals C dV dt, would have been what you remember as the voltage-current relationship for a capacitor. These are slightly different. There is the derivatives on the left-hand side. But then, L and C are not just inductance and capacitance. They are inductance and capacitance per unit length. Because of that, the dimensionality is consistent as before, okay? By having dV dz, we have a division by meter on the left-hand side. Therefore, there should be a division by meter on the right-hand side, and that is embodied in script L. Script L is Henry's per meter and not just Henry's, okay? So then, the fact that you are using this per unit length, capacitance and inductance, reminds you that your VI relationship should be slightly different. There should be C derivatives, okay? Remember that. And then, there is this weird minus sign there, and blame it on I guess on Lenz's law or something like that. That's where it's coming from. All right? So it's easy to remember these equations. So what am I going to do? I'm going to take another derivative of the first equation. So the left-hand side is now going to be d squared dvz squared. That means that I have to have d dz here. I will push it through the idt, through the ddt. So I will have L ddt of the idz, but for the idz I can substitute minus C dv dt. Okay? When I do that, I get rid of I, and I get a single equation in terms of V. Try it. You get this equation. And that looks like a wave equation. One of the telltale signs of a wave equation that we encountered earlier on, there was both the time derivative in the second order and the space derivative. It was Laplacian, but for one-dimensional problems, that Laplacian actually boiled down to a second derivative in Z. This is exactly the same equation that we saw before. So let's remind you of exactly the same equation that we had before. This was the exact equation that we saw before, right? So then we remember Professor Feynman's results or claim or whatever principle. Same equations have same solutions. The solution that we have for the V waves, and V wave is nothing but the accompaniment of the E wave, is also going to be D'Alembert-like, okay? And instead of mu and epsilon, we have L and C, okay? However, mu and epsilon played a role in the previous theory. L and C are going to play the corresponding role. And what did mu and epsilon conspire? Well, 1 over square root of mu epsilon became the propagation velocity. So we're going to take 1 over square root of LC to be the propagation velocity. And also, square root of mu over epsilon became our intrinsic impedance. Our intrinsic impedance is now going to be L over C, same as mu over epsilon. Okay? With those changes, I can write my D'Alembert solutions for the solution of the wave equation coming from telegrapher's equations. Here it is, this thing. My voltage variation along the line as a function of position z as well as time could be any function, any mathematical and differentiable function of f of t, except that I have to consider t to be replaced by the delayed time, t minus or plus z over v. And this v is going to be determined by this equation. My V is 1 over the square root of L times C. Now, L is proportional to mu, and C is proportional to, David? L is proportional to mu of the medium that is separating the two conductors, and C is proportional to?
Theta.
Epsilon.
Yeah, perfect.
Epsilon is a different vector than theta. Even though they start with the same vowel in our language, they are not the same things.
Yeah.
All right? So, moreover, when you multiply these two, what's going to happen to the geometrical factors? They cancel out. So this guy is nothing other than 1 over square root of mu epsilon. And it better be. This voltage wave is the same. It's moving with the same speed as the electric field wave. And so is the current wave. That current wave is moving with the same speed with the h. And e and h are also moving with the same speed. Okay? Whatever the speed of light is. Or, if it's not vacuum, whatever the speed of electromagnetic wave in that material medium is. And that is 1 over square root of mu epsilon. Okay? All right, so D'Alembert solution. Okay, we are permitted then the following picture. So we can have a transmission line of some length L. We will always put the load side on this side and the source side on this side. We're always going to put this to be the z-axis. Okay, for now, I put the origin of the z-axis here, where I have the source end, and after some length L, we come to the load end. And at these ports here and here, the load port and the source port, I will be forming the interaction of this transmission line with lump circuits. I will have some sort of a lump circuit here, and a lump circuit here. This lump circuit is often going to be nothing other than a single resistance that is terminating the line. Okay? At these two ends, let me call this source or generator end. I will use ECE 110, ECE 210 analysis techniques. At the load end, same. But in between, I'm not going to use anything from ECE 210 or 110. Instead, I'm going to use this thing. So, D'Alembert solutions of telegraphers' equations govern the interior of the transmission line. Where the transmission line ends at two ends and interacts with the rest of the lump circuits, KVL, KCL, all the stuff that we learned in 210 dominates. Okay? Don't expect the current here to be the same as current here. If you think of this as a node and we want to apply the Kirchhoff's law that current in is equal to current out, okay, that is problematic. Don't do that. The only thing that you apply on the transmission line itself is D'Alembert solutions of telegraphers' equations. They are very easy, and you combine them with lump circuit analysis at the two ends, they are also very easy. So we have a very easy solution to very important problems. And that's what engineers do good, right? They solve problems and then they use them to create all the good stuff that we have, as well as the bad stuff. All right, any questions? The selection between the good and bad is outside the scope of engineering, okay? But sometimes in the service of good stuff, sometimes we do dangerous stuff that can potentially create problems, right? Solutions of those potential problems still belong to the electrical engineer, or the whatever, engineer, let's say. Electrical engineer mostly, but anyways, right? So as we create new technologies, we do generate some potential hazards, but solving them is also our problems, and then we do a good job in general. All right, so that's how it's going to be. These are very important solutions, D'Alembert solution. They are so important that let me, in general, mark the total voltage at some point here, V of ZT, okay? And I am Z-specific here. This thing is different at every different Z. That is going to be, in abiding with D'Alembert solution, it is going to be nothing other but some function that has a T minus Z over V variation, added to it, superposed with it, possibly, a wave that is going in the opposite direction. Instead of T minus ZV, I have T plus ZV. That's all. Okay, and perhaps these two functions are different, so let me select another name for that function, G of T plus Z over V. That's all. That's how it's going to be for the voltage on the transmission line in compliance with telegraphers' equations. Now, how are we going to find our V's and G's? Well, we have to look at the source end and the load end. That's how we're going to find it. Okay? Those are going to be specified by what sources we excite this transmission line with, etc. Any questions? So what about the current? Okay, so we go from voltage to current. Now, in terms of electric and magnetic fields, all right, we got our E sub X as a D'Alembert solution. Then when we went to Faraday's law or Ampere's law to get the H sub Y from E sub X, what did we find out last time? We found out that we can get our H field by dividing the E field by an eta, which was the characteristic impedance, intrinsic impedance, I must say, the square root of mu over epsilon. And we also had to change some directions. And by the time we changed directions, we found that right-hand rule is always obeyed, which means that for forward propagating wave, our H was pointing in Y direction, but for the backward propagating wave, if we take the reference of the electric field to be in X direction, it was in minus y direction that the h was pointing out. So there was a plus minus discrepancy other than that division by eta, right? So exactly the same thing happens, okay? I don't have to derive this, but here is a little derivation, okay? If I want, I can substitute my f of plus and minus for the moment. Let me just single function, minus plus z over v, and substitute this as the v inside any one of the telegrapher's equations, and then solve that for I. Okay, so that's what I'm doing. I'm picking this equation to follow. I do my substitution. I do my differentiation. In my differentiation, u is t plus or minus z over v. So there is a du dt that is 1. Anyway, I follow it. My result, let's just focus on the result, because by now you guys can handle this type kind of algebra. The result is I of ct is f, the same as the voltage, divided by z0. That z0 is now square root of l over c. Okay. And remember that L and C are proportional to mu and epsilon, but they are also multiplied by a geometrical factor, but different for each one. Because of that, ultimately, when we calculate this, we find 1 over the geometrical factor that has been defined with respect to C definition, times square root of mu over epsilon. Now, square root of mu epsilon, we know what it is. If it is air, it's 120 pi. Okay? So 120 pi divided by the geometrical factor, that geometrical factor typically reduces 120 pi to something smaller, okay? The most ubiquitous transmission line that we use in the lab, RG58, has a Z0 of 50 ohms. And you address aspects of this question in one of your homework problems. 50 ohms Z0 is very typical. Unless it is said otherwise, we will assume this. Just like 120 pi or 377 was a standard impedance that related E to H, on most transmission line, either 50 ohms or 75 or something like that is going to typically relate then the voltage amplitudes to the corresponding current amplitudes. Any questions? Yes?
It seems the voltage and the current, either of them is dependent on the load.
I am not talking about the load yet, because I am now only discussing the issue of the solution of telegrapher's equations and the wave equation. I am going to talk about them as soon as I look at the two boundaries. Okay, this is why I said I don't know what those functions f and g are. To determine those functions f and g, I will have to look at the source and the load. But I'm not there yet. I'm postponing that for a few more minutes. I'm just getting there, but let me do it in my own way. But a good question. It's a good insightful question, which means that you're thinking about the overall problem. So then let me write something that should be kept in your mind from now on, for a while at least. Okay, on the transmission line, we are going to have an arbitrary Z, a voltage, and I'm going to erase it because I'm going to write it over there. At any arbitrary point, we are going to have V of Z of T that is measured from one wire to the next one. In our original definition, the reference wire was on the bottom, then the other one was on the top. Now I'm reversing that. Typically, we think of the voltage drop from the top wire to the bottom wire. Okay, so V of C is exactly that. And that polarity I'm putting here so that you're not confused. And then there is equal and opposite currents that are flowing. That is also a function of position Z. And I'm going to refer to I of Ct. And I of Ct has the opposite arrow in the other wire. Okay, and now, as a result of what we have just said, okay, in very general terms, without looking at the endpoints and the load and the source, I'm going to say that at any instant in time on a transmission line length, we expect the following relationships to be true in general. V of Ct is going, of course it could be zero, but if it is not zero, it is abiding with the following. Some function t minus z over v added to it some other function t plus z over v. I interpret each of these waveforms as forward propagating and backward propagating waveforms with the same velocity. Which velocity? Is the velocity is 1 over square root of mu epsilon, because the geometrical factors don't even come into picture. Okay? The corresponding current, it can of course be zero, but it's not going to be zero unless this is zero. Okay? The interesting case, it is not zero. And Lee, because you've been listening to me, help me out what I'm going to put here. I am going to divide that by what I call Z naught, my 50 ohms. And then what else? I'm going to make one more change. There is a plus sign between F and G. What am I going to do that with that? You say it. Plus can only go to minus. He's right. Okay. Thank you. So F of T minus Z over V minus G T Z over V, both divided by Z. Okay? So in short, remember this. A forward propagating voltage wave on a transmission line is accompanied by a forward propagating current on the same line. And our convention, and we are consistent with this, is that we always put the current defined by I of Z of T, we are defining it to be the current that has the arrow from the source onto the load coexisting with the same wire that we label as plus in our voltage definition. That is our consistency rule. Okay? It is always going to be accompanied by a current in the going from the on the pertinent wire from source to load that is obtained by dividing your voltage simply by Z naught. Okay? But the same transmission line simultaneously may be carrying another voltage wave, which is traveling from the load towards the source, and it is also accompanied by a current waveform that is also traveling in the same direction. And to get that current, you take the voltage waveform and divide it by Z naught, but put a minus sign in front of it. That minus sign is just there for these reasons. Mathematically, it comes because you do that algebra. And the telegraphy equations tells you there is a plus and minus difference between positive and negative going waveforms. Any questions about this? Okay, so we have these important results, and I have still 10 minutes, and I'm glad I have still 10 minutes. And here are some summaries, right? V can be the superposition of these possibilities. I are the corresponding superpositions of the corresponding possibilities, but with sign changes. Z0 is playing the role of eta, and Z0 is not equal to eta because of geometrical factors. 50 or 75 ohms are typical values. And we only envision the voltages and currents that are permitted on the transmission line using these laws. But these laws, these results can be evaluated at Z equals 0, that is the source end, or at Z equals L, that is the load end. And there, these total V and I's evaluated at those locations are going to be then the voltages interacting with the lumped elements over there. There, those voltages you have to treat in the same way you have been treating voltages and currents using KVL and KCL in lump circuit analysis. Questions? Okay, so now, how are we going to use this? Now, this was a bit of a math, but easy math, but now we have to sort of like see how we can apply it to more general transmission line problems in some physical way. And that's what we're going to do next. I'm going to erase this too, because it should be burned into your brain. You don't need to see that. Okay? D'Alembert solutions, there is a sign difference, and division by Z naught, that's all. Okay, so now, let's think about the following scenario. I have a transmission line of some length L. Okay, initially there is nothing going on. The voltage is zero, the current is zero, it is dormant. I have a battery. Let's say I have a 3-volt battery that is separate from the transmission line, but it has some excess plus charges on one side and it has excess minus charges on the other side. And at T equals zero, I bring this transmission, this battery, and make its terminal touch the terminals of the transmission line for a short period, and then separate the voltage back, source back out. Okay, so that's what I want to do. Intuitively, this tells me that as a consequence of this, I should initiate some sort of an activity on this transmission line. That means voltage, which used to be zero, is going to go to non-zero. But then this thing cannot spread out instantaneously. It will follow D'Alembert's rule, okay? I will generate some sort of a traveling pulse on this transmission line. And as this pulse is traveling, there's going to be current and voltage associated with it. It's going to go all the way until it can hit something, and then it will decide what to do, okay? Now, an important aspect of both plane wave equations of Maxwell's equations, Plamen solutions of Maxwell's equations, as well as the D'Alembert solutions of the telegrapher's equations and the corresponding wave equation, is the fact that waves that are traveling, these traveling wave solutions, do not get reflected for no reason at all. They only get reflected if they encounter an inhomogeneity. In a homogeneous region, a forward-going wave keeps going. Okay, it's not going to come back. It's not going to magically, halfway through, decide I'm going to go backwards. It only does that if it hits a discontinuity. To make this more specific, in homogeneous regions, the plus and minus going wave solutions are non-interacting. Okay, interactions only take place if the medium has spatially varying mu's and epsilons and parameters. Then you have partial reflections, total reflections, whatnot. Okay, so if I start a pulse traveling in this direction, I expect to be exciting only the f of t minus z over v part, not the other one. Okay, the other one is not going to be excited until that forward propagating wave hits this end, and then the system decides to do something. The only thing that it can do is, well, to adjust. The only other option is it's going to instigate a minus going wave, and that's going to be part of the picture. The equations that we have will allow us to solve these types of problems. Okay, the two D'Alembert solutions are going to allow us to decide this stuff. Okay, so let's continue. At t equals 0, I make these things touch. And when that happens, this excess plus charges and excess minus charges sort of like leak out and sit for a moment at the front end, at the termination, the connection port of the transmission line. Okay? What do I mean they leak out? Well, there is excessive electrons are mobile, electrons will actually leak out. But the battery can keep its pluses and minuses sort of like. What makes it battery is that it has an internal chemical structure that is always capable of providing those excessive pluses, minus, so that you have a 3-volt difference between them. Okay? So what happens on the top is a little bit more interesting. It's not that plus charges leak out. It is that there are equal numbers of pluses and minuses on the transmission line wire on the top, except that the plus charges there are stuck. They are not mobile. Minuses are. And those minuses actually migrate into here. Okay? To kill out the pluses, but those pluses are not killed because the battery is supplying more pluses. As soon as you kill its pluses, battery magically creates some more. By the way, the actual inner workings of batteries are tremendously complicated. I was discussing with Alex the other day. We don't have a single course on batteries in ECE because other people design batteries. We don't do that. It's physical chemists who do it, all right, or sometimes physicists. So batteries are these magical things, but they work. We know that they work. We have them in our cell phones and all that. And the better they are, somebody is making more money, right? You increase the lifetime of a battery by a factor of 2, then Apple or whatever is producing iPhones, they charge us for that. So it's a very fruitful, important area of research, such as we don't do that too much. I always brag about electrical engineering, saying that we do everything. Here's an exception. This is not something that we do too much. But anyways, so minus charges go in there, leaving some excess plus charges. That's what happened. Then I pull out my battery. I'm left with now, I can forget about my battery from now on. I am now with this situation. What goes on next? What goes on next is that there are all these minus charges that are mobile that are seeing some excess plus charge there. They are attracted to there. They rush there and they neutralize it. But then leaving some plus charges over there. Okay? So now the pluses have moved on. And this is happening at the speed of light, or it is happening at the speed 1 over square root of mu epsilon. Okay? And these guys don't want to be far away from there. They get as close as they can be, they come here. So now we have a propagating pulse. That propagating pulse is described by a function f that has its time and space variables arranged in this fashion. Okay, because we have a pulse, I can now say, hey, if my pulse was very short, okay, if I had intense very short pulse, I can sort of replace this f by a delta. All right, so we have sort of like instigated some of the delta excitation that is going to travel down this line, and then it will hit the edge, and it will do something interesting, come back. Why don't we sort of like pursue this idea and effectively derive in some sort of a quasi-physical, quasi-mathematical sense. The mathematical sense is because we are going to be using D'Alembert solutions. We know our constraint. Why don't we, following this routine, come up with, I would call, the impulse response function of the transmission line. Okay? Because if I get the impulse response function, then what will I do? What do you usually do with your impulse response function? You don't eat it, you convolve it, right? You convolve it with? No, not frequency. You convolve it? Any function. Okay, so in a, once if we have the impulse response, and let us call the impulse response as h of t. Actually, it's going to be h of z and t. For every location, we are going to have a different response. We're going to have an impulse response function. That is the response of the transmission line voltage for an impulse input. If we know that, then the response of the same transmission line to any f of t can be calculated by convolving f of t with this guy. That is what we learned in ECE 2.10. For linear system response, impulse response is a key. It's a key for finding the system response to arbitrary solutions by first working out the solution of the system to an exceedingly simple input, namely the impulse. An input that doesn't exist in real life because impulse is so weird. But still, you can think of it in hypothetically and come up with the solution, and then you use real stuff. Any questions? Okay, so let's, we have a, this thing, okay? And this thing is now traveling with the speed v. Okay, at some point it's going to be close here, and at some point it's going to hit the end. This is where Li, end results, are going to start making some importance, okay? Now, the way I have it, my transmission line is terminated with an open circuit, okay? There is nowhere else to go. Had I put a resistor here, or a short, things would have been different, okay? So let me first analyze the open circuit case, and then I will analyze anything else. Now, anything else, of course, could contain capacitors and inductors. While we are doing time domain analysis, I will not consider capacitors and inductors because they get complicated. I will just use resistors, shorts, and opens. And then when we go to into frequency domain analysis of the same thing, we will know how to handle capacitors and inductors and stuff. So now, let's get almost to the end. Now, we are very close. Our pulse has come to here. And then the last bit of electrons are sucked into this. This is neutralized. And it comes here. And it comes here. By the way, during this time frame, okay, I have my, of course, voltage that I measure from top to bottom, which is impulsive. And I have also my current that is flowing in this direction. Okay? Charges are doing moving, positive charges are being moved in this direction. So I have a positive current on this top. On the bottom, electrons are being moved in this direction, but the current is opposite to how the electrons work. So I have an equal and opposite current on the bottom. Now this physical picture is corroborating what we have seen from more mathematical ideas earlier on, right? Sam? Okay, so that is the picture. Okay, so I and V are coming in. And at the end, of course, when I that delta function finally eventually hits that end where there is no short, that current has to go to zero, which means that something happens at the end that launches something that cancels the current associated with forward-going wave. And current associated with the forward-going wave can be very nicely canceled by the current going in the opposite direction, because currents going in the opposite directions have a minus sign in front of them. When you add a plus something plus the same thing in minus, that goes to zero. Okay? So physically then what happens is that finally, all the pluses come here, they have nowhere else to go, and what happens in the next instant is that the charge carriers that are free charge carriers, electrons here, are pulled into here, they neutralize this guy, and the plus now returns to this guy. Sorry, this is minus. Okay? Return trip has started. Now, what used to be this has turned into delta of t plus z over v. Okay? But we have to be a little bit careful there. So, I think I'm running out of time. Give me 2 minutes. I will start an idea so that we can continue. Okay, since we have these functions, one representing a forward-going wave, and then one that corresponds to the reflected version of that forward-going wave, when finally a reflection takes place at the inhomogeneity, and this inhomogeneity is the end of the line. Okay, I start constructing something that is like this. I start a bounce diagram to keep track of what is going on. This is the term, okay? My horizontal axis is z, and I go from 0 to L, okay? My vertical axis running downwards is increasing time. This is t, okay? And I'm going to graphically associate with this function a line, a horizontal line, okay? That line is showing where that delta function is peaking, at what location z at each instant in time. People think, distance-time diagrams or Minkowski diagrams. There are different names that you want to give. But it is important that it comes to the end at this specific time, which is L divided by V. At L divided by V, the forward-going wave hits the end, and it sort of like dies there, with the exception that it produces the backward-going wave. Okay, and that travels and hits back at 2L over V. Okay, this is the forward-going wave. This is the backward-going wave, delta of T plus ZV. But I'm not complete. I have to add something here. This is not correct. I will start it by correcting this. I have to add something or subtract something there. Okay, so what we are now starting is a graphical impulse response function visualization in terms of the bounce diagrams. We'll have our H, and then we'll convolve that H with any other function F to proceed. Okay, thanks.